Culture eats strategy for lunch, and informed cultures drive decisions and inspire action. At the Data Culture Podcast, we talk with execs, visionaries, and data experts so that you may move from idea to outcome in your own data culture journey. Welcome to the Data Culture Podcast. My name is Sid Atkinson, data culture innovator and consulting leader with over 21 years in data. With us today is Shay Fabode. Shay is a man of many, many talents, entrepreneur, a visionary, a philosopher, poet. But one thing that is consistent through all of that is his overwhelming passion for how might we build sustainable cities, healthy and vibrant cultures. So Shay, welcome to, it's awesome to have you on today.
Thanks for having me, Sid. I'm excited.
Sid, I was intrigued. You know, you and I grabbed coffee, we talked about different things, and obviously your, you know, if we look at like a quintessential definition of a Renaissance person, like you just have so many different things, like a polymath extraordinaire. But then we focused in on this recent post that you made on LinkedIn that garnered both a lot of attention, but also I saw it and was like, oh my gosh, hey, this would be a fantastic topic because this idea on decision making and how we look at decisions is fascinating. So for everyone listening, if you don't mind, could you just walk us a little bit through the post and what the post is and what motivated it and how we, you know, we are going to use that for the basis of our discussion today.
Yes, no, it's great. Thanks so much, Sid. So I'll start by, I won't read out the post, but the idea, right. The general idea of the post was, and most of my posts come from conversation. It's someone I chat with and he or she says something that sort of fills a puzzle out for me. And so I'd had a conversation around early stage investing and making decisions as a founder in business. And we sort of landed on opposite ends of how you make decisions. Is this other person was quite insistent on data decision making. It's purely database. It's how you remove bias and stuff like that. I was like, well, I will suggest that there are some instances where intuition beats data, because and what intuition really is, which is the point of the post, in my opinion, what intuition really is data you've captured from repeated actions or decisions that then help you to say, you know what, my gut says this is the path I should take. Yes, it's your gut. It is intuition, but intuition, I think, is sort of built from insight, curated over time from doing things over and over again. And so the example I used in the post was about the Ammophila wasp, which is a wasp that has to lay her eggs in a paralyzed victim. It could be a beetle or a spider or caterpillars. And the eggs of the Ammophila wasp have to be laid in a victim, paralyzed after the wasp stings the victim. The wild thing is this has to happen super quickly and the wasp has to paralyze, not kill, the vector, essentially, the vessel that will hold those eggs. And consequently, the wasp has to find the right nerve every time to make sure the sting ends up putting the victim in a state that it can host the eggs and not die while hosting the eggs. And what has happened over the evolution of the wasp is it just does this. It sees a caterpillar and knows where to sting, which is kind of astonishing considering the different sizes of caterpillar. They for the most part, are the same shape, but when it sees a caterpillar, it needs to know what nerve to paralyze it versus when it sees a spider to know the same thing. So at some point, intuition is really all the wasp is going on, which is built out of doing this a lot of times. And I think that's how the best leaders at early stage companies or the best managers of people, I would suggest, end up using their gut, maybe this is what we call it, more than they might like to admit is the reality. But and for me, based on my experience, that has happened to be my most relied upon tool in my 20 or so years of being in business now.
Yeah. I wonder if there's, if we look at maybe there's a potential element of truth to both of your positions, right? You know, because I think on one hand, you wanted this person to say, like, admit that, and we all see the data. We actually, the funny thing is we see the data. We see the data that says that there is actually both a lot of intuition, but also I don't want to necessarily say non-value add, but non-critical to the success. So, i.e. your networks, who was introduced to you.
Exactly.
Everything from who introduced you to, exactly. to that investor guides that decision.
Yes.
But the piece where maybe we bring the two worlds together, and I think you already know this, but intuition, as you pointed out, is based on repetition, and repetition is based on choices we make in how we, you know, feed our system, right?
Yes.
And build that intuition.
Yes.
And so the intuition can then be based on data. It's almost like there's a phrase we use a lot in our team, you know, slow is smooth, smooth is fast, which is comes from you know, military references on if you train and train frequently,
yes.
and train slowly and smoothly, then you will eventually be very fast at this because it's a practice motion. Like going into a martial arts event, so the person who thinks more probably loses.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right. So then I guess the question next for you then on this, if we work from that premise, you know, how do we think or look thoughtfully at the practices we do that will then later feed the intuition?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. I'll use an example of my older kid who does fencing. I'll share some data about fencing and then tie it to the response here. He is a left-handed fencer. He's 10 years old. And at the local level, only 1 out of 9 kids are left-handed fencers. So they only practice with, for the most part, right-handed fencers. He only practices with right-handed fencers. And the right-handed fencers only ever meet a left-handed fencer at the local level once out of 9 bouts. And then at the state level, that number goes up to, I think, about 3 out of 10. And at the national level, it evens out about half and half.
Okay.
He wins a lot more bouts at the local level because the kids he's fighting against, some of them are better than he is.
Mm-hmm.
They do not have enough rep of going against the left-handed fencer. So all the data they have is about right-handed fencers. He has data about right-handed fencers. And the funny thing is, even when he meets a left-handed fencer, he also struggles a little bit.
Yeah.
What am I trying to say here? It is, you build your intuition, and your intuition might even be better than the data some people have gathered about the decision. because you have gotten more reps of making similar decisions as you go. And I think a long-winded way, but I think the story will stick in people's minds. The more reps of a type of decision you make, even if you're making it, because he hasn't been fencing for more than 2 years. He doesn't have all the form and the approaches and the tactics down. He is, at this point, a purely intuitive fencer with a little bit of training involved. So I think in both cases of, he fences with against a lot of right-handed fencers, he's gathering data about how, what works for him against right-handed fencers. But the next time he meets a right-handed fencer, he is going to rely more on his intuition. And even his coach was telling me the other day, he goes, man, his intuition is fantastic. I just need to now add a lot more practice, structure, tactics, so that he can match that intuition with practice, which I think you mentioned earlier, but also with just a repository of information on approaches and how he can handle things beyond just going with intuition. And I think we do this a lot as business people as well. And I'll speak for myself. I fall into generalities a lot, but I then remember I need to come back to speaking for myself. I have found that intuition is a lot about, maybe unfortunately sometimes, but for the most part works, is a lot of qualitative information captured and converted into quantitative information.
I like that, a lot of qualitative information that we then parse,
exactly,
find ways to make into quantitative information to inform this computer, this computer of ours.
Exactly.
So I'd like to just go back to the original framing real quick, because I think there's some importance in how that kind of conversation, with the other individual generate, how that came to be.
Yes.
The instantiation of this first thought here, in that your conversation with this person was around early stage investing.
Yes.
And early stage investing has a whole lot of similarities to other key decisions that even a very staid and steady or large corporation has, in that I might be trying to go do something new, different, or facing uncertainty in the market, even in the familiar that I'm doing, wherein decisions are now facing shades of gray or just complete blank spaces, right? Mm-hmm. The canvas could be entirely blank.
Yes.
And so there is a massive amount of uncertainty in all of that.
Yes.
And that is, both the, yes, the other person you're talking to, there's always data that we could look at, but many times, like, the data that we would most desire to have and make a decision doesn't exist.
Exactly.
Or is not readily accessible. So I think frame up, if you don't mind, continue that piece a little bit and let's lay this out, why this is important, because it's not just early stage investing. It's even for, we all, whether small business owner, large business owner, we all face lack of information. And so then therefore kind of go back down, like drop from the head to the gut.
Yes, exactly.
It's like, and the fear, it's kind of almost like, as I say that, it's almost like the fear increases. It's like going down the roller coaster. The fear, it's like you drop from the head to the gut, the fear goes up, right?
Yes, yes. And I'll frame it up in that way and make, highlight a point here. The conversation we're having was around how the pattern matching is sort of how early stage investors like to say, hey, I've seen a founder like this, and this person thinks like this, or this person is working in a space that I intuitively know is a market ripe for disruption. And the point I made to this other person who was a founder, and sort of like me, we're both thinking of going into the investment side, and how do we, where will best work for us is on the investment side. And so what I was framing for this other person was, at the early stage, you have the least amount of information you can have about a founder or the business they're trying to build. And consequently, a data-driven decision at that stage is you trying to convince yourself that you have enough or enough valid data to make a decision. If we quickly go to a business decision in that sense, in decisions where you have the least amount of data or the least amount of good data to inform your decision, you will rely on whatever models or ideas you have in your head, which will be represented as your gut, because you don't have information about the current situation to truly say it's a data-driven decision. It will most likely end up as your gut. And what you're trying to do after you've made that gut-based decision, say as an investor, is add more layers of data and hopefully good data to say, oh, this was a good decision or this was a bad decision. And when you have a little bit more data, you then say, do I want to, for example, as an investor, double down on this investment or cut my losses and say, this isn't working out? And we do this on the investment side. There's this fantastic interview of a lady, Cyan Bannister. It's on a different podcast, where she talked about how she was at a fund, and I heard this after my conversation. So it just validated me to the point where I sent a text to this other person. I go, this is what I was talking about. And she had framed it this way. She joined a fund as a seed stage investor, where it was all qualitative intuition. She was in a cab with a driver who was the first cab driver for Uber. And she asked the cab driver to reach out to her when, I think they're no longer an employee or something, when this moves along a little bit, because she intuitively realized, man, this dude is sharing this with me because it has changed his life in some way. Made an early angel investment in Uber, and there was next to no data at that point. She had made it based on this conversation, the gut response she had to this person sharing what was changing his life in terms of the flexibility and the additional income he could receive. As we move further in the life of a business, we now have a lot more data, both as an investor, but also as a business person, to say, what does the data say and what does my instinct, my gut, or my qualitative insight say about this situation? And consequently, we make a decision one way or the other. Some of us will, even as we have a lot of data as later stage investors or as owners of bigger businesses making a lot more decisions, some of us will still rely on a lot more of our guts than our intuition. Yeah. Sorry, than the data. But I would suggest even your gut, after you've been running a business for 10 years, is more about the information you've gathered over the 10 years through the reps you've done than just some seat of the pants gut decision that isn't based on any real data. So I hope that answered the question, because it's really about rebalancing the type of information you use to make a decision as you mm-hmm. gather more information to make that decision.
And I like that term rebalancing, because I've written down several questions. So I'm trying to sit there now, think about which order I want to ask these questions.
Please, yes.
So let's start with a little bit there. I think there's this interesting drive, well, not interesting, this fantastic drive towards transparency, particularly in AI models and in data science models, right?
Yeah.
And that I want explainability, right? Like I want to understand the weights. How did this come to this decision? How can I make sure that this is a fair decision, ethical, biased, responsible, and you know, fair? But then at the same time, we haven't necessarily cracked the black box of our brains on the intuition.
Yes.
And you see, and there's, and one of the thoughts I went to is like, okay, well, where do we see examples where the explainability in human decision-making is attempted? And so me having done, and do you actually experience this too, doing business with government, right?
Yes.
So I think the classic, you know, the classic example is the attempt in fairness. And so from the outside, it can look like a very frustrating process, but when you understand it and what they're trying to do is that they're just an attempt to put fairness into the decision-making with all these weighted scores on how they judge a company and how they judge the service offering. And, you know, but yet at the same time, like you and I have both competed and said, but you know, they, you know, we know deep down, and then time proved out, they didn't pick the right vendor.
Yes.
And I've heard it many times over. It's like, oh, we would have loved to have selected you, but, and then they give like this thing. And so, you know, I just wonder then on the related question to all this is then how do you challenge? So just like they should challenge those models, right?
Yeah.
If there was something that says like that we would have chosen you. Okay, well, why? Maybe you need to go update your scoring system to figure that out. So on a related note, how do you or you challenge yourself or others, you know, when the data and the outcome tells you that your gut was wrong, right? Like you got to figure out, it's like, how do I update the intuitive model? Because now the intuitive model led me to hopefully not a very adverse, but could have been an adverse, you know.
Decision. Yes. Yes. So it's such a good question that will help add context to my previous response. Even in the rebalancing point I made with decisions, there's this, and I'm sure you've heard this before. There's this idea of the one-way door and the two-way door. Decision making. Mm. So the one way door is, if I make this decision and I go through the door, the decision being the door, there is no coming back to the previous state, essentially. And the two way door is saying, I can make this decision, go through, if my gut says it's, if I realize it was a bad decision, I can just come back and make a different decision, go through a different door, I make a different decision. If you hold that idea of the one-way door, two-way door, and then add in the making of the decision to go through one of the two, one door or the two-way door, you can also frame the one-way door and the two-way door as big decisions with huge consequence on the one-way door if it goes wrong, and not so consequential for the two-way door.
Mm-hmm.
I find that even as I rely on gut for my one-way door decisions, I will gather data from people who are, and I'll use it in a business. I'll use a business example. I will gather data from the entities that I believe can allow me to improve that decision because I know how consequential it will be. And I think that should always apply in terms of the, how do I challenge my gut decisions? If I've made a wrong decision and it was made based on my gut, and it's a one-way door,
yeah,
I better be ready to adjust my model, quote unquote, because I'm now needing to, one, address the consequences, but also make subsequent decisions, especially if it's something I want to achieve down the line. I would do this a lot running my most recent business, Varuna. We had a few heavy data-driven team members. And for those one-way door decisions, I would always pull them into my decision-making. They wouldn't mm-hmm. make the decision for me, but I one guy, an environmental engineer, PhD, he would always look for the data. He would always look for the data. And I'd go, hey, JP, I'm trying to do X. What do you think? And the mm-hmm. first few questions he would ask would be around, what do we know about this situation? Can you give me a day to go capture some more information to help inform this decision? And so the balance is always, the rebalancing is always critical for decision making, in my opinion. And then the consideration of the weight of the possible consequence should inform how much balancing you do. I would never make the one-way door decisions purely based on gut, is maybe the summary there. Yeah.
No, I think that's a fantastic way to frame it up in the decision-making gut. How do we inform our gut and look at these decisions, or find a way to frame the decision so that we know the weight of what we're doing, and then yes. therefore how to challenge ourselves.
Yes.
I forget. I think Amazon has made this famous, right? Like the John Nodder's, you know, the sense of urgency.
Exactly.
And so I think the bias for action is yes. the core value over at Amazon. And I think it's framed very similar. I like the one-way door, two-way door.
Yeah.
I'm going to put that in the show notes because that's a great way to do it.
That's awesome.
They look at like decisions that can be rolled back versus ones that can't, right?
Yes.
As kind of the same concept. So I think then, you know, a couple follow-on questions.
Please.
Like digging into this a little bit. So what guidance would you give folks for looking at and understanding whether they are facing a one-way door or a two-way door decision? Because sometimes it can be overwhelmingly obvious.
Yeah, yeah.
But sometimes it is not. And so kind of what are your ways for framing and understanding that? Because I love how you said, okay, when I have these one-way door decisions, I'm going to seek things like a JP.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
How do I know my one-way things, and how do I find my JPs to challenge me?
Yeah, no, it's a fantastic question. And for that one, it's been a lot more of, again, coming back to reps. I'll use one instance of what was a consequential decision that mm-hmm. on the back end, I realized it was a more consequential decision than going in. Yeah.
Okay.
And so we were working with a customer up in the Northeast, and they had come to us for a particular solution. They'd seen us demo somewhere, mm-hmm. had conversations with them. They decided to give us a contract, but as a big contract, but as the contract was being discussed, they decided to change the need. So it became, they will become our largest customer, but it will require us to change our product, to serve the need they've brought to us. And I went into it thinking, oh, this is a two-way door. It's literally the, this is a two-way door. I need to get the customer. They're a big one. They will benefit us in a great way. Turns out it was the one-way door. It was a one-way door. But if I go back to making the decision about how do I know it's a one-way door or a two-way door, I waited the impact of getting the contract over what it would do to our business internally. It was, oh, what will this do to our business? Took a sort of a back seat, and the contract became the predominant factor for making that decision. What is the lesson for deciding what is a one-way door versus a two-way door? For me, it now boils down to the waiting of the outcome. So if it's a decision that could bankrupt your business, that is a one-way door. And unless you choose to ignore the weight of bankrupting your business, then, and in the middle of the decision making, it didn't feel like it would be a big problem. It didn't feel like that. And so it in the post assessment, I kept thinking, if I'd only waited this side a little bit more realistically, I would have realized this is a one-way door. Is it one we want to go down? And I'll fast forward and say, we never quite fulfilled on that promise because we would have needed to fundamentally change the business we were. And consequently, it never happened. That contract never went forward for us. But we spent 6-7 months going back and forth, sending them engineering design, schematics of the changes, trying to get their approval, parameters we would measure for them. It was such a mess. And I kept seeing our whole team waste time on what should have been a clear, clear in hindsight, but
yes.
Did that answer your question?
It does. It does. And I think it's, you know, to be fair to you, we all, and this is the challenge of the entrepreneur, like in the attempt to go create the new and the different, it's our desire to serve the customers that we are looking at can lead us to see many of the requests as like very valid, right?
Yes.
And particularly when, you know, the request that this customer most likely made of you still felt within the wheelhouse of what Varuna was doing. From water management. And telemetry. It's like, okay, well, this feels like on brand with the mission, on brand with the company, you know, on brand with where we want to go. But then you can easily, you know, this is where, to your point, like it actually can be very hard to see the one-way door versus a two-way door because you can say, okay, this is core to us. But then in the kind of survival instinct of, I need to bring revenue in. So then now that gets weighted and that big anchor is sitting out there and you're like, oh my gosh, that anchor's right there. And then you justify that anchor by the fact that this feels like it's right on brand with our mission. And then you miss the points like, oh, but, you know, like it's gov, so this contract may not come through. You know, they probably actually have a whole committee of decisions, and maybe I'm talking to somebody that has a good idea, but then they still may not end up buying all
exactly.
The same. So you, like, all these things can easily get lost because of the two big anchors that are sitting out there.
Exactly.
I'll touch on yourself some slack.
Thank you. I do. I eventually did. I'll touch on one other thing about the one-way door, two-way door thing. Mm-hmm. And we will, the comfort I give some of the founders that I work with, or even as I build businesses, is that I will get it wrong. I'm pretty certain yep. there will be instances where I will get it wrong, whether I'm using intuition or data. Mm-hmm. What I need to be able to do is quickly adapt or adjust from that point. So when I've gotten to the other side of the door and I now have enough information to tell me that this was a bad or wrong decision, the speed of adapting or adjusting now becomes the mm-hmm. most important thing. Not that you got it wrong. It's how quickly do I now take the new information I have and make a different mm-hmm. decision to either address the mistake I made or move on from the mistake and just keep moving forward.
And so I think I have a couple of other questions, but I want to also like kind of summarize what we've talked about a little bit yes. so far. It's like when to use intuition.
Yes.
Right? And then we've talked about how to challenge your intuition, i.e. knowing when something is a decision of import and weight, i.e. the one-way door, or when you can reverse the decision, the two-way door.
Yes.
And then we talked a little bit then about how to update your intuition.
Yes.
So the other one is that sometimes it's actually the intuition still could be right if the anchors around it were recognized properly. So like for going back to your example, you actually, had you seen the anchors drawing down the decisions of, I want this big contract, this, and then this thing feels like it's core to the mission, so let's proceed.
Yeah.
Like those anchors might have blinded what could have been the intuition that saw that this isn't core.
Yeah.
And we need to say thanks, but no thanks.
Yeah.
Right. So how have you, Shayif, spotted anchors and been able to address those? Because you could still then end up with rapidity in decision making. But once you actually address and anchors and reframe
yes.
the question or the opportunity.
Yes, it's a really good question that I'm still sort of working through. One idea that...
Aren't we always though?
Yeah, it's true. That is true. One idea that a really good friend of mine who is a business owner as well, he owns mm-hmm. a fantastic independent bookstore. He here in Austin, he told me that the way he's always approached sort of even in our lives, I'll use an example. In our lives, you say, man, should I start this business or take this job? You know, and we now put anchors on those two things. Yeah. Or should I buy this thing or build this thing as a business owner? Mm-hmm. He goes that when you feel like you're stuck between like two weights, mm-hmm. add a third. It's like add a third. And if you think you only have two paths, add a third, that it will help you. The third one will always help you reweight the other two, and don't just add a random third. Give you in the build or buy decision, the third one could be wait. Don't do anything. Mm-hmm. Just mm-hmm. stick with the current business lines, for example. Mm-hmm. That same wait makes the other two. It rebalances the other two anchors a little bit because you're like, you know what? If I don't buy or if I don't build and I wait, what are the consequences for me? And mm-hmm. having that third option as an additional piece of information is really what it is.
Mm-hmm.
helps you adjust the weighting of the other two. And ideally, it leads to a better decision because you're really giving yourself a third door, maybe. You might end up still making the first two.
Yeah.
One of the first two choices, but adding a third, I found, and this he shared with me, we always grab dinner at the turn of the year. We don't make resolutions, but because we're both building businesses, we just talk about, what are you struggling with as you come into 2024? And he shared that framing with me at the beginning of this year, and it's been really good for adding a weight to the anchor, an additional anchor to help decision making, but also just sort of make it less binary with some of these decisions that we're trying to make. Yeah.
Well, even make it, not only just making it less binary, but providing framing to it, right?
Exactly.
Because then, it's like in that, you know, the classic, I'm an existing business. I might buy something or I might build something for a new product line or new something. But then you can sometimes forget, to your point or to your friend's point, that there's that third of don't do anything, keep status quo.
Yeah.
Which, you know, sounds silly, but also can help frame the importance of doing, you know, it might frame the importance of I actually need to do this, or, oh, I created a false importance in needing to do this.
Exactly.
And that there's actually, once I frame up the cost of doing nothing, like, hey, this was tangential to our mission or our customers, and our attention's needed over here.
Exactly.
And there's actually a whole new slew,
of opportunity,
bunch of other over here.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I love that. I love that point on the, just put the third, put the third thing out there and make it real.
Not just something random.
Arbitrary.
Yeah. Yeah. That's been super helpful for me.
I love this. So I've loved this discussion. So we've covered like when to use intuition, how to challenge your intuition, how you can update your intuition, you know, how to spot the anchors, and then this final like awesome little point from your friend. So, you know, thank you to your brother
Eric
there. To Eric. We'll all have to visit his bookstore.
Yeah.
If you're in the Austin, what is his bookstore?
It's called Black Pearl Books. It's on Burnett.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Awesome. Yeah. Well, fantastic. Well, we will thank Eric for that idea. Che, what are you up to these days? What people want to connect with you? Where should they connect, and what should they follow about, you know, your next entrepreneurial ventures or ideas?
Our next
or investing?
Step. Yeah. So no, thank you. I've really enjoyed this because not often do I get to think and frame how I think. So I'm so glad you made us do this. I am always interested in cities, sustainability in cities, and building thriving cities, especially as a lot of advanced technology gets dumped on us. There's a need to be thoughtful about that. So I'm currently considering a few options. I continue to write about cities. You can follow me on LinkedIn, where I will continue to write about cities and technology. I have a digital publication all around cities, utili.city. And I publish there regularly. And I'm currently talking to a couple of funds, either to join or to start my own, even as I continue to tinker with product ideas. So I'm in an exploratory phase, which is a fun phase for me because it's fresh, it's new ideas, it's conversations like this that open up different avenues of thinking. So LinkedIn, utili.city, and I also provide some consulting on embedding advanced technology into your business if you're a mid-cap sort of infrastructure, IoT type company as well.
Awesome. Fantastic. Yeah. Well, I appreciate your time today. It's been a fun discussion.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening and being an advocate of the data culture community. Curiosity intersected with data can inform and inspire change for the betterment of all. Let's build cultures to make this happen. If you have a topic, want to be a guest or chat, reach out to me, Sid Atkinson, or my co-host Lee Harper on LinkedIn via DM or via the Data Culture Podcast LinkedIn group. If you haven't already subscribed to this podcast, please do so anywhere you get podcasts. Be sure to join our LinkedIn group to engage with your fellow data culture changemakers and visionaries. Thanks again for listening.